It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, the era of the hit TV show may have come and gone, with only a small percentage of Americans watching even the most popular programs. We'll talk to a television scholar about why and what it means for having a shared media culture. Now, we've learned on the show in the past that friendship can take a lot of different forms, from best friends to maybe those friends you do one specific activity with, like meeting to play a sport. But what if we expanded our idea of friendship even more to consider something we might not normally think about? Being friends with someone from a different generation, someone maybe much older or younger than ourselves. We want to hear your story about friendship. Do you have friends who are either significantly older or younger than you? How did you meet? Why do you like being friends with them? Have you learned things from them you wouldn't have known otherwise? Email ideas@WPR.org or you can tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Ellen Lem is a professor of English and honors program coordinator at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee at Waukesha. She's the author of the book, Gray Matters, Finding Meaning in the Stories of Later Life. We talked to her earlier this year. Well, what do you think are some of the benefits to having friendships with people who are, you know, not in our own age cohort?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a really good question, and I went today just to get some ideas thinking about it to the website of the Eisner Foundation, and that's really, they really emphasize intergenerational relationships, and there was a quote that really struck me, is that sometimes it's a good way to find one's kindred spirit, and I just thought that was a really good beginning way to start the conversation, is that we are so often trained to think of that the only people that we'll have someone in common with will be people our own age. And yet, you know, you can look around at people who have the same age and realize that that is no indication. So I think instead matching up with people of common interest can be really rich, as well as there's just a lot of studies on the benefits both for the old and for the young in terms of finding this kind of connection, especially as people experience loneliness, both young and old.
We've heard on the show in the past that people have a hard time sometimes finding friends, period. Can you talk about how hard it could be to find friends maybe of different age groups who we might not normally run into in the social activities, say, that we do on a regular basis?
Right. I mean, I think it really takes first just opening up one's eyes and perspective, because they do feel as if we're all sort of trained to our age group alone. And so, for example, instead of just thinking of, you know, I could only be friends with somebody who is of my same age group, expanding that. For example, I started doing a water Tai Chi class with my mom at the YMCA, and it is mostly seniors who are in there. But once I was in the water and started talking to people, we formed all kinds of connections. And now I see somebody coming to class who's pregnant, and we're of all different, you know, backgrounds and ages. And it really is taking those blinders off that we self-impose, that says either this activity is only for this age or this person and I must not have anything in common because, you know, we're clearly of different generations. So some of it is, you know, individuals have to do on their own and, you know, pursue what they love without thinking about age being attached to it.
I know you watch pop culture a lot for how it portrays older people in particular. I want to give a listen to a new show from HBO. It's getting a lot of buzz. I don't have HBO. I haven't seen it. It's called Hacks, and it includes main characters with an intergenerational, I don't know if it's a friendship, at least at the start, but intergenerational
working on it.
relationship. Yeah, here's a listen.
You see that antique shop there?
Yeah.
Okay, I want you to go in there, and I want you to buy this for me.
I'm sorry, what is that?
That is a Jean Royer pepper shaker, and I want it. But I can't go in. He'll gouge me. He'll get a much better deal.
Oh my God. That's why we drove all the way out here. You didn't want to spend time getting to know each other. You just wanted a pepper shaker mule.
Bit of a non-traditional work relationship, but workplaces are one place where at least sometimes we interact with people from different generations. Can that be a good meeting starter, a good intergenerational friendship finder?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, in different ways. I remember a couple of years ago when I was teaching a class on aging, and my students had to interview somebody who was in their 70s or 80s. And one of my students said she worked at a bar, and she said didn't have any relatives. And she said, "Well, I'm really friendly with this regular customer. Can I interview him?" And I said, "Absolutely." So, you know, sometimes it's, you know, whether one person is working, the other is a regular. But since now we have people over 65 in the workplace like never before, there are all kinds of opportunities. I know my son worked in Madison at the Union in the there was an art studio there, and that his coworkers were many decades older than himself. But I think that there are interesting connections that can come from the workplace. So I agree. I think that that's an excellent starting place.
Talking to Ellen Lem from UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha, looking at intergenerational friendships. You can join in with your stories, experiences, maybe at 800-642-1234. A lot of you are calling in, so let's hear from you now. Lisa starts us off in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that when we lived in England, I volunteered with an organization called Age UK, and we were matched up with an elderly individual in the community who maybe didn't have family or couldn't get out. And I was in my mid-40s, and I was matched up with the most amazing woman in her 90s, telling me stories about living through the bombing of London and going into the underground, her philosophy of life, and the things that I learned from her have really propelled me to continue to maintain friendships with older people when we moved back to the States. And I just found it invaluable and, you know, a wonderful experience.
Lisa, did you manage to find a similar matchmaking service in the U.S., or did you have to do some of the legwork on your own?
I did the legwork on my own, but I've often thought it would be something I've thought about starting and looking into establishing, because it really was such an amazing experience.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Lisa. Ellen, so she in England found, in the UK, found a matchmaking service to actually intentionally help build these intergenerational friendships. Good idea?
Oh, I think it's an excellent idea. And I do know that there are organizations. I know there's something called Newbridge here that does that kind of match up. And what I love what Lisa shared was that oftentimes that people have an idea of, oh, I'm going to volunteer and help the elderly. I'm going to help someone older by volunteering. But what her experience indicates, and I think a lot of people as well, it's a reciprocal relationship that the person who is maybe younger and, you know, may be doing it at first, like out of the goodness of their heart to perhaps, you know, be with people who have less company, but the riches that they take in terms of hearing those stories and learning from their experience is just really invaluable.
Thanks for that call, Lisa, at 800-642-1234. Let's hear now from AJ in Eau Claire. AJ, hello.
Hi there. Yeah, I am really glad you guys are putting on this program. So I've always tried to make friends that are older than me just because they are much smarter than me, and I love to learn from other people's experiences. At one point in my life, in like the last decade, I needed short-term housing. And so I just on a whim put a request out for housing on Craigslist and was answered by this older person. He's 67 now, and I was very reluctant at the time, but he rented out rooms in his house. And it was supposed to be just 2 weeks that I would rent from him. But I ended up staying with him and the other people that he rented from for 2.5 years.
Wow.
And we became such good friends and have vacationed together. And he is the most important person in my life, and actually walked me down the aisle last summer.
Aww.
And so, it's just really important to go outside of your comfort zone and learn things from people that have lived experiences and want to get to know you.
Wow. AJ, thank you so much for sharing that. 2 weeks ended up being 2.5 years and getting walked down the aisle, Ellen.
Yeah, and that's such a fantastic story. And I really like, too, the way that you put it, AJ, about, you know, your first impression was like, oh, this is strange or this is odd, you know, which is what a lot of us have been trained to believe. Like, oh, you know, this person is like outside of my comfort zone, exactly as you put. But once you can get past that, there is sort of infinite possibilities of connection. And I'm so glad that that individual had the idea to put the room for rent and that, you know, you found each other. It seems like it was really kind of a moment of fate, but both of you also just being willing to open up your boundaries of what normally conventional friendship looks like.
Thanks so much for that call, AJ. And bringing things back to pop culture, Ellen, I mean, that sounds like a pitch for a sitcom almost. Right. And I know you have concerns about the way aging and older people are portrayed in popular culture. What are some of the red flags you worry about when we watch a show where, you know, a sitcom writer might have taken that scenario?
Right. Well, I do. It did come up in, I'm thinking of the Betty White TV show that was something in Cincinnati. It's not one that I've studied, but I know a little bit about Betty White. And oftentimes when older people are portrayed on TV and movies, it's often with exaggerated characteristics. They're made into be comical. And it's like really hard to tell sometimes, are we laughing with them? Are we laughing at them? And so that's one problem. Another one is like the setting up sort of a generational antagonism. There's a show that came out recently called The Politician, and in it, Judith Light plays somebody running for Senate, Dee Dee Standish, and she's challenged by a young NYU student. And there's just so much antagonism between young and old, and the jokes fly. And I just feel as if that doesn't help us, that that's going to perpetuate those stereotypes that people who are in different age categories have nothing in common.
You can let us know if this story is part of your life. Do you or someone you know have a friend or two that is older or younger than you, of a different generation? How'd you meet? Would you like to have more friends of different age ranges? What do you think this kind of friendship can offer? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our talk now with Ellen Lem, professor of English at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha, author of the book Gray Matters, Finding Meaning in the Stories of Later Life. We're talking about intergenerational friendships, and you could join in to share your own stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Stevens Point. Jim, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. In Stevens Point at the university, the radio station is run by students and has students hosting college alternative radio during the day. But on weekends and in the evenings, they have community volunteers that get to volunteer their talents to host shows. And I've been doing that for about 25 years, and I've been able to make friends with students at the university as well as other community volunteers. And it's been a great opportunity to make friendships with people not my age.
Jim, thanks so much for sharing that story. Ellen, volunteering can be a great opportunity to meet people, I imagine, from different age groups.
Absolutely. And, you know, in addition, just the idea of universities, they are such a great place for people to come together. Older people can audit classes oftentimes for free. I have had students in my classes, up to someone who was in his 90s, actually taking the class for credit because he had never gotten his bachelor's degree. And it really infuses a classroom to have people who have had real-world experience and come in and share their ideas. So both through volunteering and university settings, lectures in foreign arts, book festivals, those are all really great places to meet somebody outside of one's age, but with a lot of things shared in common.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. With that example of how you've met people intergenerationally, that's 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share. Ellen, you pointed us toward a new movie called Here Today about an unexpected friendship. Here's a bit of the trailer, with a couple of friends-to-be, I guess, meeting in a restaurant.
Thank you for bidding on me in the auction. I am so flattered that somebody your age would be a fan of my work.
I don't know who the hell you are. My ex really wanted to meet you, so he bid.
How much?
$22.
$2,200? That's fantastic.
$22. It started at $20, and then it went up in 50-cent increments.
Why are you pointing this toward, this sounds like fun, why are you pointing this toward this movie, Ellen?
Well, it is an unconventional friendship. Billy Crystal plays a veteran comedy writer, a widow, who, because of sort of almost like an accidental connection through this auctioning, meets somebody who is many years younger than him and a very different profession. She's a New York street singer and played by the very talented, very funny Tiffany Haddish. And what's really neat about the movie is that while they don't seem to share much in common, it's not a case of friendship about common interests, but it is still people can find a connection. And in this movie, she is able to bond with him in a way that his family isn't, that he puts up some types of barriers. He's losing some of his mental faculties, and he is afraid to come clean with his family. But somebody who is a little bit of an outsider, who doesn't have that, but who just has a big heart, they make each other laugh, they enjoy each other's company, and he can be real with her in a way that he can't with others who look up to him as being a role model because he had this celebrated career. So I think a lot of lessons come from that movie about intergenerational friendship. And it's just newly released. I just saw it last weekend.
We're talking about friendships between generations with Ellen Lem, professor of English at UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha. She's the author of Gray Matters, Finding Meaning in the Stories of Later Life. If you have an intergenerational friendship story to share, still time for you at 800-642-1234. If you encountered a busy signal earlier, that line has opened up now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ellen, for generations, we've talked about concerns about a generation gap, inability to understand younger people understanding older people or people my age even, you can call it older, I guess, worried about kids today. How can these kind of friendships help bridge those maybe misconceptions we have about each other?
Yeah, and I think that's really what I am finding interesting about the television show Hacks, because the convention of the show is that the long diva-type comedy performer played by Jean Smart, people are feeling like, oh, her act is old. We need to bring in some like new talent. So they hire somebody in her 20s. And so on the surface, it seems as if, okay, we're going to have this infusion because they're so different. But despite their differences, there's so much commonality that comes across, and even in their antagonism, but so much that they share, that it really shows that these are arbitrary when we make these statements about boomer generation or the millennials are. They're sort of like creations of our own that putting up barriers that are really not necessary, because there's more that links human beings together than what separates us.
Let's go back to our callers now. Gordon is with us in La Crosse. Gordon, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to call and let you know when my story is about intergenerational friendships. A neighbor of mine invited me to the Cheese Land Duke Band, which met every week at the Moose Club in La Crosse. I went there, and it was pretty crazy, about 50 people every week getting together to play ukulele. Most of them were over 60. And that turned out to be one of the most fun part of it, as being with people not of my age group, appreciating each other and each other's talents. It was pretty cool before COVID.
And hopefully you can get back to it again, Gordon. Thank you so much. Yeah, Ellen, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I'm really glad with that call, because it is a reminder about our neighborhoods, too. And now that we are all sort of coming out of hibernation again after COVID and getting to see our neighbors again, I mean, neighborhoods are a great place. I know here in Waukesha, where I live, that my neighbors, you know, next door are people that have babies, and I know people on the block who are in their 80s, and we look out for each other. Those conversations that we have casually in the street are great opportunities to realize that everybody's got these stories and that are worth sharing with one another, even though we're at different points in life. So it was great to hear that neighborhood story, and, you know, with the ukulele connection about, you know, because I do think that music is a great unifier. And that's another pop culture example that won a couple of Academy Awards, was this movie Sound of Metal, about a drummer who loses his hearing, and he eventually becomes, he finds someone who's like a mentor to him, who had also lost his hearing late in life, and who also is in recovery from drugs and alcohol. And you really see how helpful it is that somebody who has had some experiences to help lead the way to a younger person. So that was another a really good example of intergenerational friendships.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Ellen Lem from UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha, author of the book Gray Matters. She joined us to talk about intergenerational friendships. Coming up, must-see television events might be turning into a thing of the past. We'll talk about the downfall of the hit TV show and what it means for the media world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Whether or not we've actually worn much of them in the last year, most of us have a few pairs of jeans in our closets. The average American woman apparently has 7. While we don't usually think about it when buying, that pair of jeans has been all over the world before we bought it, including maybe cotton farms in Texas, a stop in China where the fibers are spun and dyed, woven into denim, then maybe Sri Lanka or Bangladesh to be cut and sewn, before coming back to the U.S. to be shipped out to a buyer. Our next guest has been trying to find out more about who makes our clothes and the larger consequences for consumers, workers, and the planet. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made it a priority to try to buy clothes in a more sustainable way? Do you find it difficult to find sustainable and affordable options? Have you tried to find clothing with a Made in the U.S. label on it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Maxine Beda is director of New Standard Institute, a nonprofit working with scientists and citizens to make the fashion industry more sustainable, ethical, and equitable. Her new book is called Unravel: The Life and Death of a Garment. Maxine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's set the scene. You were for a little while trying to get into the clothing business, and you walked into a huge, huge clothing exhibition with a simple question for a lot of the sellers: where did your clothing come from? What kind of answers did you get?
Yeah, this was at the convention center in New York, a very large convention center, and it's kind of the mall of all malls, basically, where buyers from across the country come together to plan their next collections, the retailers. And I went asking this very innocent question, you know, where do your products come from? And I got a lot of blank stares, a lot of people kind of throwing their hands in the air. I got vague answers like Asia. I got very bad answers like the Orient. And it just made me realize just how little the industry knows about its own story, its own history.
And even when I see a label that says made in China or Pakistan or something like that, really from your travels to the places from where the cotton is grown to where things are dyed and so on, a lot of our clothes are really multinational in origin. Can you talk about how hard it is to come up with one country to put on that label?
Yeah, it's very hard, and it's very misleading because, you know, your clothing is very rarely just made in one place. As you laid out in the beginning of the segment, the fiber might be grown in one place, then it's shipped halfway around the world to be spun and woven and dyed in another place, then probably shipped somewhere else to be cut and sewn, you know, to only then be shipped maybe around the world again to be sold to you. So it's very difficult to just put that one country on the map, and it ends up being kind of a legalese question as to what country it is actually sewn into the label.
So you set out to try to track one particular item of clothing, jeans, the ultimate American item of clothing, not made in America for the most part anymore. Why jeans in particular?
Yeah, jeans are such an iconic item. You know, I'm wearing them right now. I think, you know, as you said, most of us have a pair of jeans in our wardrobe. Over a billion are sold. Pairs are sold a year. And so, you know, it cuts across socioeconomic divides. It is this very much sign of Americana. And yet in the clothing industry more broadly, while in the 1960s, 95% of clothing that Americans wore was American made, today that is less than 2%. So our jeans kind of talk about, you know, the rise of our own industry and then its decline and kind of the consequences of all of that.
Talking to Maxine Beda, her new book is called Unravel, The Life and Death of a Garment. Well, I want to visit a couple of the stops that you took along the life path of a pair of jeans, starting in Texas. Apparently, we produce a lot of cotton in the United States and a lot of that in Texas. Can you start us off with the birthplace of so many jeans and the cotton grown there?
Yeah, so the U.S. is still a major producer of cotton globally. It's the third largest producer of cotton, and West Texas is kind of the heart of cotton country in the U.S. And so I spent time both with what is now called conventional cotton farmers and organic cotton farmers to understand better the decisions that have led them down that path. And what I learned, you know, from the organic cotton farmer, you know, Carl Pepper, he said he's a natural tinkerer, and that's why he was really willing to engage in something that was potentially very risky, because in the cotton fields, getting an organic certification takes 3 years. So a farmer has to invest and take risks and start doing things differently and doesn't see a benefit necessarily for another 3 years. So it was really important for me to understand, you know, if we want to move to a healthier agricultural system, the risks that farmers who already have a very, you know, risky profession, what it is that they're facing.
And now I want to go to China and Bangladesh, different parts of the lifespan there, and focus in on a particular issue, the environmental impact of what goes from turning that raw cotton into the clothes we wear on water and more. Can you talk about some of the things you saw actually in both countries?
Yeah. So China is where most of the textiles globally are produced. And what people don't really connect with yet is just how much of a climate impact our clothing has. So the clothing industry has a higher carbon footprint than France, Germany, and the United Kingdom combined. It has an enormous impact, and that's because it takes a lot of steps energy intensive steps at these mills to convert this raw fiber into a textile that we're actually going to wear. And the additional challenge is that we're producing these jeans or these clothing in countries with very cheap energy. And, you know, globally, that cheap energy means coal energy. So we're using the dirtiest forms of energy to create a very energy intensive process. And so resultingly, you have this industry that has just an enormous greenhouse gas emitter, in addition to the chemical pollution that it results in and the plastic pollution, because today in clothing, the number one dominant fiber is polyester, which is a plastic based product. So it's, you know, the environmental impact is enormous and cuts across many different areas.
And then you visited, among other places, places in Bangladesh where those textiles are turned into the final product, the clothes we end up wearing. Can you talk about the experience of the workers you saw in action there and who you visited actually at their homes?
Yeah, so I got a chance both to see garment workers, you know, in action, working at production lines, and then follow those workers into their own homes. And I think the thing to keep in mind with clothing production is that it hasn't really changed in the last 100 years. So I certainly took my clothing for granted. But when you walk into a cut and sew facility, it's rows and rows and rows and rows of people, up to 40 people on a line producing a single garment. So they're all sitting behind sewing machines and they're responsible for just one element. And it's made the most efficient system with industrial engineering so that a worker is just doing the same process over and over and over and over and over again. And the very difficult part engaging in this subject is that I learned that this industrial engineering actually got its start on the cotton plantations in the South during the time of slavery. So it's this same approach of really trying to get the most out of a human. And then, of course, we're now moving to this space where the human is being replaced by a machine. And then, you know, just following that garment worker, you know, I was really curious to understand what are they thinking about, you know, during their day. And, you know, the woman responded to me, "I feel like I'm in a prison." And she said she didn't get, you know, she doesn't have time to think about her life. She's just constantly thinking throughout the whole day, don't make a mistake, keep going faster, don't make a mistake, keep going faster. And I think we really have to think about that really kind of devastating, mind-numbing work, in addition to the very low pay. And this woman, I was in her home, the size of my bathroom, you know, in a New York apartment that fit her and her husband and two children. So kind of, you know, while the bosses at the top are kind of some of the wealthiest people in the whole world. So that was kind of the dynamic that I was able to see while I was there.
We're talking to Maxine Beda, director of the New Standard Institute, author of the new book, Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how clothing is made? Would more transparency from companies make you more likely to buy their clothes? Transparency about where their clothes are made, what the conditions are for workers, the environmental impact. What do you want from brands? Do you think about these things when you are shopping for an item of clothing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through Wisconsin Public Radio sponsorship. For more information, call Jay Johnston at 414-202-1961.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Maxine Beda, director of the New Standard Institute, author of the new book, Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment, looking at a huge industry, the clothing industry, an invisible industry in many ways. We buy the clothing, but the story of how it gets to us is often below the surface. You could join in with your questions and your thoughts on how you shop for clothing at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I heard the opening introduction. It reminded me of an essay. I think it was called Eye Pencil. And I'm not sure if it was the great Dr. Friedman that came up with it, but I heard it from him. And it just talked about how no one knows how to make a pencil. You know, where does the rubber actually come from and what goes into that making that rubber? What about the little metal clip and the wood and the lead and everything that goes into it? And it's just amazing how all these different organizations and each person getting a better life as a result of making it, no matter what part of the world that you're in. And all comes down and shipped to a store in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, for me to buy, whether it's jeans or a pencil. And it's just amazing that everyone's life is enriched as a result of having that job and that opportunity.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, as far as the mechanical side of that, Maxine, yes, the pieces may come from a lot of the countries. Is everyone's life enriched by the opportunity to participate in the system of making the clothing?
Yeah, Steve, thank you for your call. I think, you know, what I uncovered is, you know, just how unequal the system actually is. And so there has been research on whether these garment worker jobs and the distribution jobs as well, that's closer to home in the United States, whether it's actually improving people's lives. And the research is not straightforward on that. So I think, you know, part of the point of the book is, you know, how we can actually make these jobs, good quality jobs that people actually receive a living wage, because there's no evidence of garment workers receiving a living wage that would allow them to feed their children, to educate their children. But we can move to that place. And I would agree with the caller on this, that it should be a system and can be a system, but we would need to change it from what it is right now.
Steve, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Maxine, you write that there's such a system of outsourcing and middlemen and that kind of thing, to where a big brand name like, say, Levi's doesn't actually do much in the way of making a pair of jeans. They're more of a marketing entity. How does that affect accountability when we have these, you know, tragedies like one in Bangladesh or stories of abuses of workers?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a big thing when we started outsourcing our clothing production is that the institutions that we fought to create, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency, which came about in part from when we saw in our own rivers that they were dyed the color of the latest textile trend. That is what led in the United States to develop things like the Environmental Protection Agency. It was women garment workers in the United States that fought for basic labor protections, including things like the concept of the weekend. So when we outsourced this, we did not include these protections in our international trade agreements. We essentially just created this race to the bottom for the lowest, you know, to move to countries of production that have the lowest wages and the lowest environmental protections. And so I argue in the book that we really need to rebuild up those institutions globally and put them in our trade agreements so that we can have this a race to the top and not a race to the bottom.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Eau Claire. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for answering my call. Two quick things. One, having lived in Madrid for 4 years, two things. One, I'm wondering to what degree do the United States garment makers go to foreign countries to know how to get the highest quality out of their clothes? For example, having been in Marrakesh, the dye in Marrakesh was unbelievable, both in the clothing and in the leather industry. So that's one thing. To what degree do we go to find out how do they make this incredible dye? The second thing is, traveling Europe, to what degree does the clothing industry look at the styles? Having lived in Madrid for 4 years, they were 3 years ahead of us in style. And so I'm wondering, both in the quality and in the style of garments, to what degree do we search that out in the United States so that we can be the leaders and not having other countries.
Well, Jim, thanks for the call. Your thoughts on that, Maxine? We don't make a lot of clothing in the United States these days, for starters.
Yeah, exactly. We're not making much of it anymore. And so a company like Levi's that once owned factories, and the original idea of brands started out from factory owners, you know, trying to demonstrate the quality of their products. But, you know, as globalization rolled out and was pushed, these companies completely switched how they operated. So a company like Levi's, which owned factories, stopped owning factories altogether. They don't produce any clothing. They are in the business of marketing, maybe designing, but not all the time. You know, they're products that are made, you know, far, far away. So, yes, you know, the whole industry as a result has become global in terms of chasing the latest style, chasing the cheapest production. But we're not going to that, searching for that place of quality, which is what I argue in the book. We really need to turn to is to focus back on quality that we once had.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Maxine Beda. Her new book is Unraveled: The Life and Death of a Garment. We took just a whirlwind tour. You went to a lot more places and dug in more. I want to get to some of your recommendations, especially for clothing consumers, Maxine. What kind of things are you hoping people come away from your book thinking about as they think about when and how they buy clothing?
Yes. So, you know, I spoke to a lot of shoppers, you know, about their own relationship to clothing. And I think that, you know, I'm an older millennial, but I spoke to millennials and also Gen Z. And there's just this incredible shift that people need to know about in terms of the exposure to the number of ads that young people are exposed to. So 50 years ago, people were exposed to about 500 ads a day. Today, they're exposed to up to 10,000 ads a day. So we're being bombarded with these messages to shop more, to buy more. And it's really problematic for the environment. As a result, our wardrobe doubling in size. We buy twice as much clothing and wear it at half the time than a generation ago. So there's this real shift. There's a survey that came out that 1 in 3 young women consider clothing old after wearing it only once or twice. So that's the relationship that we need to start to think about with our clothing. You know, if we want to live in a thriving planet, it's really as simple as that. And so the idea is to take back control, like from the messages that are being sent to us, and build a relationship of, you know, of real love and appreciation for all that has gone into the clothing. And I think that's the place, you know, that we can be more sustainable, is if we reconnect to our clothing, understand its history and appreciate it more, the more we will wear that clothing, and the more we wear it, that's the greatest driver of resource reduction use. So that's going to be the most sustainable thing we can do, is to wear our clothing more and to really love it.
And briefly, you also suggest some policy changes. Can you share something that's at the top of your list that might make a difference?
Yeah. So in terms of policy, and what I chart out in the book is just how much it's been an American policy to actually get people to see themselves as consumers versus citizens. And so by actually showing that history, we can kind of regain our identity as citizens and move this policy. And kind of one of the biggest areas of policy is work around kind of unions as a way to increase wages. And then to build back those, or to build for the first time in an international context, requirements that the standards that we have in the U.S. are the standards that we would expect globally. And that would be a benefit for the environment in total, and also would be a benefit for American workers. So we're not putting American workers, pitting them against the very cheapest labor elsewhere. We can really have a level playing field. And that's the work that we're doing now at the New Standard Institute.
Maxine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Maxine Beda, director of the New Standard Institute, a nonprofit working with scientists and citizens aimed at making the fashion industry more sustainable, ethical, and equitable. We would talk about her new book. It's called Unraveled: The Life and Death of a Garment.